This episode of Does Not Compute is brought to you by Hired. Anyone who's tried job hunting in the design or development fields knows how much of a pain it can be. With Hired, it's actually super easy. You just sign up, fill out your profile, and awesome companies will come directly to you with interview requests. Those requests include salary and equity information up front to help you figure out which companies might be a great fit. Hired works with over 4,000 employers in 17 of the major tech hubs across North America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. Hired is completely free to use to find your next job. In fact, if you do find your next job through them, they'll give you a $1,000 thank you bonus. Even better, sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute and they'll double that bonus to $2,000. It's a fantastic way to find your next thing and support Does Not Compute at the same time. Thanks again to Hired for sponsoring the show, and make sure to check them out today at hired.com/doesnotcompute.
So, Paul, I did a thing a few days ago.
What kind of thing?
A purchase-y type thing.
Uh-oh. What'd you get?
I got a MacBook.
Yeah?
The little 12-inch MacBook.
How are you liking it?
I like it a lot. It's actually my favorite Mac I've ever owned. I've owned maybe three different generations of Pros now, and an iMac, and now a MacBook, and I like it a lot.
You like it the best out of all of those?
It's probably just because I just got it and I think it's cool, but yes, I like it a lot.
They're pretty nice little computers, and you're doing like work on it?
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, every day I'm working on a NodeUp and a Rails app in tandem. So I have those both running. I mean, Slack is running. I mean, that's a resource hog too. Chrome is running, email's running, Spotify's running all day. So yeah, I'm working on it and hasn't felt underpowered or slow to me yet.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And granted, I mean, I'm not running like five different VMs on Docker at the same time either. But for me, it's a perfect form factor. It's light, small, screen's crisp. I can fit enough stuff on it. I think the other day I tweeted that during that day I'd worked on a Rails app and a Node app. I had recorded some music in Logic Pro, watched some Netflix on it, and had no problems at all.
You're running even stuff like Logic on it then?
Yeah, Logic Pro.
Nice. That's awesome. What were you using before?
MacBook Pro with 16 gigs of RAM and the quad-core CPU.
That's pretty incredible that you can do such a downgrade in terms of raw numbers, but still have a machine now that works for everything you need to do.
Yeah, and like I said, I haven't had any troubles yet. I asked a few people before getting it, and they said they hadn't had any, and that seems fine. I asked some people on the Spec Slack, and they said that, or one of them said, Jim said that he was on the verge of asking for a RAM upgrade from his employer because he's saturating 16 gigs all day long. But apparently I don't have that problem, so it hasn't been an issue for me.
Yeah, that's always a concern for me with the soldering and RAM is just doing upgrades, because that's usually the one thing that I always upgrade on all my computers, whether it's a laptop or a desktop or whatever. If I can upgrade the RAM, I always upgrade it to the max at some point.
Yeah, I assume that they're gonna bump it probably in the next couple of versions, and I might end up upgrading then just to have it, but for now it's been fine. And I'm in preparations to move across the country, right? And I've been working a lot more remote days just because I've had things to take care of. And the other day I worked from two different coffee shops, and I think it was like 6 hours between charges, and I still had battery left over.
Nice. That's really cool.
Yeah, so that was my favorite part, was I didn't have to worry about, because a number of the coffee shops in downtown Santa Cruz don't have outlets, so I didn't have to worry about that. Or with the roaster that I hang out has one outlet, actually two outlets, but it's kind of like first come, first serve, and it's always a struggle to get the chair with the outlet, so I don't have to worry about that anymore.
So have you been using the laptop docked to a big screen at all, or just on the little 12-inch screen?
Not yet, just a 12-inch screen. So when I am at the office, I have a 27-inch 5K iMac, and I just use that. But when I'm working from home or a coffee shop, I just use the 12-inch screen.
I mean, with a good window manager tool like Moom or something like that, plus Mission Control, I guess screen space really doesn't even matter that much anymore.
Right. So I use Divi. I've used it forever. It's basically just like Moom, but I have a bunch of hotkeys set up to rearrange my windows. And then you introduced me to Better Touch Tool a few months ago, maybe a year ago or something like that. And I never used Command 1 through whatever to change to certain tabs. So what I did was I mapped, using Better Touch Tool, I mapped like iTerm to Command 1 and Chrome to Command 2 and Tower to Command 3. So I can get to any window just by hitting one keyboard shortcut, and I just run all of my apps not in full screen mode, but they take up the full width of the screen.
That's really cool. For anybody who hasn't heard of Better Touch Tool, it is one of my favorite apps. It's just a little tiny menu bar app, and it actually lets you do a ton of different things now. But what I use it for is assigning additional gestures on mice and trackpads. So, you know, Apple has the rotate gestures and the zoom in gestures. It actually lets you take those and customize them and send custom keyboard shortcuts for any given app, and also some custom actions. But you can make those so much more useful. So I use them to swap tabs and reload pages and all that kind of thing directly from my mouse or trackpad, which is super handy.
Well, when I first saw you using it, I didn't know what it was, and you were doing this strange gesture on your trackpad. And I was like, what are you doing? How are you doing that? And then you showed me what the app was, and I've been using it mostly ever since then. I don't usually use any of the custom gestures that it has, like tip-tap or something like that, but I just use it for auto or assigning global keyboard shortcuts.
Yep, lots of different uses for Better Touch Tool. If you haven't looked at it, highly recommend checking it out. We'll have a link in show notes.
And the only other thing I find myself doing with the MacBook is I'm just closing stuff more. So I'll see things that are running in the tab bar that I'm not using, and I just close it. So for example, Screen Hero is pretty much always running, but I'm using it a few times a week, maybe. So now I just close it instead of just keeping it up there all the time.
Yeah, I've been trying to do stuff like that more and more, even on like my iMac at home, where I just don't want to have all that stuff running if I'm not using it. I'm trying to be a little bit more conscious of what's happening on my computer at any given time.
Yeah, I guess I get distracted. I tend to look at those icons, and if any of them change colors, I click on it again because they need to be looked the same in my mind. So I'll just click on them and then find myself being distracted. So for me, it's just one less thing to have to notice, because I'll notice things happening on the peripheral or on my, you know, my peripheral vision, and then I'll have to deal with them, or I just will deal with them, respond. That's something I can probably work on. But yeah, if it changes colors, I'll click on it and then I'll get distracted. So that just kind of helps solve that problem as well. And that's also why, I mean, I feel like most developers do, but I have my dock hidden at all times just so I don't see those numbers or those little badges if I don't have to.
I do not have my dock hidden at all times. I have so much stuff in my dock.
And you have it visible at all times?
Yeah.
Oh, that drives me crazy. I can't look at your computer anymore. I just see where the dock is, and I see how often you don't click on it. Maybe you do, but I assume you use keyboard shortcuts. And then I just see like that half inch of space that's not ever being used.
I don't think I ever click on it. I don't know. Maybe I should start hiding it, actually.
I mean, do what you want. It's your life.
I just like having it there. It feels comfortable to me.
Oh, Jamie has her computer like that, and it drives me nuts. I always hide it when I use it, and then she yells at me. Because I can't remember the keyboard shortcut offhand, but it's in muscle memory, and you can turn hiding on and off automatically. And I just tap it real quick.
So we were talking a little bit earlier about GitHub. GitHub has just switched their fonts across their whole site to use system fonts. So if you're viewing it on a Mac computer, you're going to get San Francisco. If you're viewing it on Windows, you're going to get whatever Windows is using now. I don't even remember. But basically, they're not loading in a custom web font anymore. They're just going to show you whatever the default font is for your system, which I think is pretty awesome personally.
I like it a lot. So I didn't know they had updated, or I didn't know they had moved to system font stack. And I went to GitHub and I was like, oh, this font looks awesome. It didn't register to me that it was San Francisco, but I was looking around. I was like, oh, I really enjoy this. So I used this site called thenews.im to kind of quickly keep up to date with what's going on, what's been released. It shows me different tabs of, I think, Designer News, Product Hunt, and Hacker News. And how you might feel about any of those sites aside, I use it out of habit now. And yeah, so I went to GitHub. I was like, this is great. And then I went to that site and I saw a few posts of people saying like, oh, GitHub ruined their design and it's so ugly. And then I went on Twitter and I saw more of the same. People were saying that it just looks terrible now. And I disagree. I think it looks great. Obviously, it's going to, you know, reflect whatever you're using on your system. So I think it's odd that people are hating on their system font because plenty of other applications on their computer are using that.
Yeah, and the first thing I thought when I saw this, I didn't even realize at first that it was system fonts. I was just like, oh, GitHub's done a little bit of a design refresh. And it looked so much more open and airy and just lighter weight. And it's actually kind of amazing how much noticeably faster it is browsing the site.
Yeah, you know what actually really drawed me to the design update first was I had GitHub in one tab and I had GitLab in another tab, and I was actually at the roaster that I mentioned, and I don't know why I keep going there. The coffee's good, but the Wi-Fi is terrible. And I would refresh GitHub and I was like, man, it feels really snappy today. And then I would refresh GitLab, which granted is probably a little slower anyway, but I kept on seeing just the labels because they're loading a custom web font, and I would refresh an issue list and I would see the labels without text. And I would see a textless page, you know, flash of unstyled text. And it was like that on every refresh. And I didn't have the design. I didn't have the dev tools open that had cache turned off or anything. It was just a blank flash. I don't know. Mainly for that reason, you know, GitHub's switch to the system font stack is great because it just removes a performance bottleneck. People aren't going to GitHub and fixating on the design, right? They're going there and using issues. They're going there and communicating. And so by GitHub, obviously probably looking at performance benefits and payload size, you know, by removing that from the equation, it's pretty easy win in terms of performance gains.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, personally, I think this is going to be one of those things where people complain a lot about a redesign at first, and then a month later, everybody's like, oh yeah, that's just what it is, and it looks fine. So I'm not worried about it. I think it looks awesome. I'm really excited. I think it's a win for WebPerf, and I'm hoping more sites move in this direction when it's appropriate for them.
I totally agree. Actually, I took a screenshot of the fout and tweeted at GitLab and I said, hey, can we get system fonts, please? And they didn't reply. But, you know, I'm holding out because I use GitLab a lot more than GitHub simply because, you know, we use it internally. Actually, I think my favorite piece of feedback that I saw on Twitter was someone had changed their system font to Comic Sans and tweeted a screenshot and they said, I think it looks great. I don't know what you're talking about. And of course, people took them seriously, and there was a whole like flame war, but I'll have to find that tweet and put it in show notes. I thought it was pretty funny.
So you've been doing a lot more remote work lately, and you're actually about to become full-time remote because you're moving across the country. So I'm really interested to hear a little bit about how that's been going for you and kind of what some of the concerns and struggles are and what's been really nice about it.
Well, I mean, the concerns and struggles have always been around communication mainly. The work doesn't matter. You can do the work from anywhere, but it all comes down to communication. And I think that I'm kind of getting into more of the habit of things in terms of like getting things kind of standardized, how I approach problems. I wrote a really quick blog post about this, but one thing that's been helping me a lot lately is the work in progress pull request. And basically when you're working on something, or if you're struggling with a bug, you can create a new branch and just prefix it with work in progress and just copy your team. And so that way, as you're working on it, you know, you have a running list of the commits and you have a place, a centralized place in GitHub or GitLab that you can comment or directly to that code. Your comments are directly related to that. And so what I've been doing is I've been creating a bunch of those. And if for example, I'm working on a backend thing and I need help, I'll assign it to Josiah and just ping him and say, hey, I need help with this thing. So he can see my commit history. I'll leave a really detailed description of the problem in the description area, which is another huge thing, is just being really thorough. And so I guess thinking ahead of time about like the communication bottlenecks and thinking of ways that you can easily solve those problems have helped a lot.
Yeah, I love work in progress pull requests. They're a big part of my workflow as well, and they just simplify things so much. It's great to have that single place that acts as a source of truth about whatever it is you're building out. So, I mean, it's discussion around the thing. It shows all the exact commits and code that are going into making the thing, and you just get a really nice, pretty visual history of what's happening in your code base. I think it's a fantastic way to work.
Right. It gives you that isolated kind of scope for that problem, which is great. So things like Slack, I mean, granted, we could talk real time there, but discussions tend to get disrupted by, you know, someone else hopping into the channel, or even if it's a PM. Again, for some reason, the information in a Slack channel doesn't usually stick to me. But if it's something like a work in progress pull request where I'm seeing communication directly around that, it's just focused, right? So we can talk about a problem in Slack and then we'll go on to another topic and that information kind of gets buried. Whereas if it's in a central location, like with a WIP pull request, it's just kind of there. Another thing that I've been focusing on, and I think it's going to help a lot with communication, is just being thorough. So if I'm struggling with something or if I need Josiah to fix something, I will be as completely thorough as I can. And I use Markdown a lot in issue descriptions now. So if it's a feature request, I'll have like a spec heading and then underneath will be hopefully, you know, a list of the complete spec for that feature. And if a client, typically we'll have certain clients in the GitLab with us as well. And I'll make sure that the client signs off on that spec first. But if he opens up the issue, Josiah sees a well-organized issue. This is the spec. This is what's supposed to happen. This is what's currently happening. And so he can just kind of get to work and not have to look around for, he doesn't have to track me down and say, what's going on here or why is this happening? If I'm kind of upfront with all of that, then he can just get to work and it saves, you know, it saves his time, which in turn saves my time. And another kind of nice residual effect that you get of work in progress pull requests is that when you go to the merge request or pull request page, you kind of see everything that's going on from like a zoomed out view, right? You can see what's being worked on and kind of the state of each branch, I suppose.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. I guess if you have a lot of separate pull requests open at once, that's a great way to get an overview of the state of things. That's a really good point.
It's been working really well for me. And I guess it just forces me to be more thorough with how I'm approaching things, thorough with how I'm thinking about the bugs or thinking about feature requests, thorough in how I'm writing them up. And I've noticed that it's affected my commit messages as well. I'm using, so I use Tower a lot for Git, and it has the short, in the commit screen, it has like the short message, and then underneath it has a text area for longer descriptions. And I find that I've been using that more and more. And what I've been doing is I'll just, you know, have like a 50 character, this is what happened. And then the text area, I'll have like a bullet point list of things that changed and why they changed. And a residual effect of that is I actually end up using those messages by myself. I'll scroll back through the history and remind myself of why things were changed.
Making your commit messages actually be useful is one of those things I think every dev starting off with source control, whether it's Git or Subversion or whatever, writes the worst commit messages generally to begin with. Oh, and yeah. Then over time, it's like, oh, wow, I actually kind of need these to be really helpful and informative. It really makes such a big difference when you're looking back through your code base, whether you're trying to figure out a bug or just trying to get some context on something that you're dealing with in the present, whatever that is, having good commit messages, oh man, it will save you.
Well, it's hard at first, right? Because you want to move quickly and writing a detailed description of something kind of slow, you feel like it slows you down because you know in that moment what's going on and why things were changed. But in the long run, I just know that it's always better. It takes more time. It takes more effort up front, but it's always better because it never fails. I'll think to myself, I'll remember why this happened, or I'll remember why I changed that. And I never do. Next week, I will not remember. And if I leave a note, then it's doing myself a favor. So it's just one of those things.
And not even just with commit messages. I think this is true with code in general. Like, unless there's a huge, huge fire, there's a major production bug that has to be fixed right now. Of course, in that case, I'll go in, write some code as quick as I can, get it shipped, get it working. But other than that, what I try to do these days is I'll go in and I'll have a goal. But if I run into things along the way that are kind of messy, I try to just, you know, tidy them up a little bit. It's the old scouting mantra of, you know, leave it better than you found it.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of along that vein, I end up doing these work in progress branches a lot because I'll run across something and think to myself, oh crap, that needs to be fixed. So what I'll do is I'll quickly stash what I was working on, make a new branch, push it up. And then next time when I go to the list of work in progress things, I see, oh crap, you know, I forgot to fix this. I mean, granted, I could probably do an issue as well, but I feel like issues tend to get swept under the rug. If you look at it and think to yourself, if you see a priority tag and then your little like cleanup thing is next to something with a priority tag, you're more likely to just kind of sweep it under the rug or close it right away or something. Whereas if it's a merge request, I feel like you treat those a little differently than a giant list of issues.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, if you already start on a thing, it kind of, I think, gets your brain working on it in the background. So if you see this thing and you're like, oh, this should be refactored, and you actually start on it and get a pull request or merge request set up, then when you go back to it later, your brain is already going to have some context on what's going on there and what needs to be done. So it's actually going to make things a little bit easier for you a lot of times.
Well, not only that, your teammates will have a context of what's going on. So I'll have people hit me up and say, hey, I've got a couple extra hours today. Do you need anything? And instead of saying, go search the issue list for something you know how to handle, I can say, well, here's a few work in progress branches that have some commits already added to them. And if I've done things right and have been descriptive in the description of the pull request, that that developer would have a lot of context and probably be able to just kind of get started on that and continue where you left off. Whereas if they're just searching for issues, you know, they might start on something from scratch and they might not be as productive because they'll probably be asking you questions and like, what's the origin of this problem? And how do we frame it, et cetera? Well, if you have a in-progress pull request, you've already worked on it a little bit. So that's all kind of there.
Yeah, I agree.
So not to change the subject so abruptly, but I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this thing I learned about last week, Paul, that I've never done before. I thought it was kind of cool.
All right.
We mentioned it in the Slack chat a little bit. But essentially, one of the projects I'm working on is a single-page application. And a lot of people ask, well, does Google index that stuff? And yes, they do. They render JavaScript and all that.
Yeah, we should point out right now, Google and Bing would both execute your JavaScript, which means Yahoo is also going to get it because they use Bing's results now.
Right.
But don't worry about your JavaScript. Your JavaScript is fine. And the major search engines, at least, will for sure execute it and index everything as you would expect. Google actually has a fantastic tool in their webmaster tools that we'll include a link to in show notes that lets you request a page and then view it as Googlebot actually sees it. And that's a great way to debug that kind of thing and get a sense of whether there's things you should be improving in terms of your JS for Google.
Yeah. In fact, most of Google's docs around that issue that mention having to pre-render stuff has a giant deprecated sign above it. Because they are, like you said, Paul, they are in fact rendering JavaScript. And I actually did that myself. I went into Google Webmaster because I was paranoid about it, you know, talking to other people and being like, are you sure? They're always like, are you sure that Google does that? And so I tested it for myself and I can attest that yes, my Vue.js single page application is being indexed by Google and rendered properly and all that. But there's a catch, and this is what I wanted to talk about. So a lot of people, especially this client in particular, they want to pay a lot of attention to how items look when they're shared on social networks. So for example, if you go to Facebook and you share a link, do the other people that see that link, do they see like a really nice image? Do they see descriptions, et cetera, or they just see the link, right? The problem there is that Facebook, I want to be clear, Google will, but Facebook will not render your JavaScript when you share links. Twitter is the same way. And so what you end up having to do is use some sort of pre-render service.
Right, because Facebook and Twitter and Slack and everything that unfurls or does link previews, basically, they are all just looking at your head and all the meta tags in your head, and they don't really care about JavaScript. They just want to see what's up there. And so if your head is actually being generated from JavaScript, all your OG tags and stuff, then they'll never see that because they don't execute JavaScript. They just request it and then parse it as HTML.
Exactly. They don't care about the content of the page. They're just looking for OG-specific tags or Twitter card tags or something like that. And so that's where I was running into a problem, and I started Googling and came up with a few different solutions. And I just wanted to mention that shortly. But probably the most famous one that I've heard of was prerender.io. And I looked at it and I was thinking, like, I don't know if they want to, you know, if I can convince my client to pay another, for the number of page views they have, it would have been like $40 a month or $45 a month. And then I found out that Prerender actually has an open source version, and the paid service is really just kind of admin around the open source version. And so what I did was I followed the setup, and it's kind of cool how it works. To break it down, you basically have server A, which would be your front end server. In my case, it's just a simple Express app. A simple Express router that takes a request and routes it to just the index page, which boots up the application. And then you have a second server, which is the actual prerender.io application. And they had an Express add-on, which was great for me. So I added that to server A, which is again my front end. And what happens is when a request goes to server A, it looks at the headers and asks itself, is this a bot? Is this a scraper? What is this? And if it is a bot or a scraper, you can actually set the criteria for that. It'll forward the request to server B, and server B, which is your prerender.io source code, that will use Phantom.js to actually render the page. It'll run your JavaScript. It'll grab the HTML and return that to the scraper. Pretty ingenious little solution.
That's really clever. And that might sound like a lot of overhead, especially for some clients. The kind of social sharing links are just super important. And as more services add those link previews, it's going to become more and more important. So this kind of stuff is very critical these days. Even Messages in iOS 10 has link previews now.
Oh, yeah. It's only getting bigger and bigger, and it's getting more and more important. I agree. But so as long as that explanation took, it took me maybe 15 minutes to set up and have working on my dev machine. So it wasn't super costly for me. You know, it wasn't a lot of overhead. All I did was spin up a new server. And the cool thing is that pre-render, they include caching. So you can either use something like Memcache, or you can use, what the crap is that called? The key value thing, Paul. Redis.
The key value thing.
Redis. You can cache your pages with Redis if you want to. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty robust, and it works well. You set it up and it does the thing, and that's about all that you can expect from it.
Very cool. Thanks to our longtime sponsor, Hired, for their continued support. Designers and developers looking for new jobs should totally give them a look. It's one of the best, easiest, least stressful ways to find a new job. After you sign up, great companies from whichever cities you pick will reach out to you with interview requests, including salary and equity information up front. They've got a special offer for Does Not Compute listeners. If you check them out at hired.com/doesnotcompute, sign up and find your next job through them, they'll give you $2,000. Seriously, it's an amazing deal. Check out Hired today by visiting hired.com/doesnotcompute. If you enjoyed today's episode, remember to rate or review Does Not Compute in iTunes. It just takes a couple minutes, and it's one of the most effective ways to help spread the word about the show.
So it wasn't supler.